This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Welcome to Breaking Banks Europe. My name, as you know, is Matteo Rizzi. I am the executive producer of the show. This is actually a show talking about fintech in Europe, as you all know. But we decided to give perspective and voice to European distinguished entrepreneurs, investors, and executives to sort of enlighten us on how they see the European scene. I'm here with my friend Simone Brunoxi in San Francisco, and I'll let him introduce himself, and you will see very quickly the reason why we invited him to the show. Ciao Simone, welcome.
Ciao Matteo, thank you very much for having me on the show. Well, high pressure. You essentially told your listeners that, you know, a big star is here on the show. Let me tell you a bit about myself. I'll try to be brief. Most Italians can't. I'm from Italy myself. I left Italy about 12 years ago to pursue a career in IT and technology with Amazon, then VMware, then startups, investment firms, my own fund, etc. And I've been in San Francisco for the last 8 years. I think as a European, after a few years in Silicon Valley or in San Francisco, somehow you acquire an interesting point of view on how certain things can be done, how speed of execution can be, but also about how there is tunnel vision in every corner of the world. The Silicon Valley itself is its own bubble. And a lot of times, Matteo and I were at a conference earlier today. He was mentioning certain companies that, of course, I know about, but most Americans in the audience would not know about. And the problem is tunnel vision or being in a bubble, even if you think if you are in Silicon Valley, you are at the center of the world. So this is, in a nutshell, who I am. I've been here for a while. I enjoy dedicating my time to technology. I also like making investments and just either for myself or with the fund that I created. And Matteo, of course, offered me to come on the show, and I've been, of course, very honored to accept his invitation. Thank you, Matteo.
So, Simo, let's start by sort of with your European hat and being here since 8 years. What are like the main differences of you mentioned speed. Speed is an obvious one. I've been here for the past 4 or 5 days, and it's clear that the number of talent, influential people, multiple exit entrepreneurs that you see in 10 square miles is, by far superior of any other corner of the planet, which of course gives you the speed and the access in a way that is certainly much faster than Europe, where the landscape is way more scattered. So what else would you add to that, Simo?
Well, speed is often misunderstood. On a superficial level, when people describe Silicon Valley, they simply say things happen faster, people seem to be on a different gear, a different essentially car, on a Formula One race car as opposed to like a, Fiat 500 or something. But actually speed should be unpacked in a way, because it is, I think, too simplistic to simply say things in Silicon Valley happen faster. There are many aspects of it. For example, having, if you are in tech in particular, having a big ecosystem, of course, gives you speed in many ways. It gives you speed because you have a large network of people that have experiences that are probably very related to what you're going through now. Let's say you are a tech startup in Europe and you are scaling to millions of customers, being a consumer app or maybe an enterprise app, doesn't matter. It is hard in a particular place in Europe to be surrounded by people that will have that experience in their past in some form and in some capacity. Here, I can imagine pretty much any type of company, tech company, of course, I'm talking about. And personally, in my small network, I have a good network, but it's not particularly big compared to anyone else here in the Valley. I can easily think of several people that can help me or could be involved or could connect me to someone that can fix the particular problem, being growth, being marketing, being sales, being litigation and patents, being M&A, and so on and so forth. The second aspect is just market. Never forget, Silicon Valley is in the US. The US, for good or bad, is by far the largest market on earth. And compared to Europe, you might say, well, the Eurozone, yes, fine, but as you know very well, if you have a company in Germany or in Italy, being able to sell your product, your services to either companies or consumers in a different country requires usually maybe dealing with different regulations, dealing with different partners, different cultural barriers. Something that works in the Mediterranean Europe doesn't work in the Nordics and vice versa. So speed is, of course, very important, as we would all agree. That's a given. But I think it's interesting when you try to investigate the reasons why speed is higher in most cases here in Silicon Valley, and how can you try to replicate that speed or try to somehow imitate the reasons why a certain company, you know, managed to grow faster here than elsewhere. And the third aspect is money. It's very simple. Here you have more fuel to go to war faster and quicker and more badass than anyone else. You have a company that grows in Europe. It is successful. For some reason, no one thought about that idea in the US. All of a sudden, you know, two entrepreneurs, maybe serial entrepreneurs, go to a VC, and in one afternoon they raise $20 million to compete with that idea. And then they decide, well, we have $20 million. We can easily attract a head of growth, a head of engineering, a head of marketing. Essentially, they have great talent that they can tap into to be able to compete with your European startup very quickly and very aggressively. Or potentially, you go there and say, hey, dear European startup, you know what? I want to buy you. And as a European, when you think of being bought by maybe an American entity or in general, an entity for tens of millions of dollars or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, the temptation is too high. Think of this in comparison with Facebook refusing $1 billion from Yahoo, or if I'm correct, $8 billion from Microsoft. And on the other side, Instagram being bought for $1 billion by Facebook. But that's a billion. I mean, so we're talking about, you know, already a pretty serious, you know, endeavor. So those are some of the elements, and I can probably think of several more that contribute to this speed that we're talking about.
By the way, guys, you know, Simone is, to me at least, very famous for his modesty, because when he said that his network is small, you know, you could, if I ask him to name, and I will not, but you can like Google him, like 10 of his mentors, you will see that his network is far from being small. So let's dive in a little bit into fintech and financial services. So the good news is that when you speak with Simone for once and you talk about Revolut and TransferWise and Number 26, you're not talking about companies as, you know, that many of the Americans never heard. Well, maybe truth is that Number 26, if you're in New York, you got a few skyscrapers with an N26. So you might ask yourself, what is it? And you know, quickly figure it out. But here, believe you me, digital banking is still not an utopia, but something that is not as common as in Europe. By the way, Simone defines himself as a tech entrepreneur, But well, not only he co-founded a couple of startups, both in PropTech and in InsurTech, which are kind of pretty close to our own world, but in the past 3 days here, he introduced me to two fintech entrepreneurs, so I am pretty sure that his knowledge is quite acceptable in this case. So, Simone, how do you see the fintech market in its evolution, right? We were talking about it this morning. So really like this big platform through open banking, trying to reach out and to scale through a digital app, open to third-party services to reach out. This doesn't seem to me a movement here. So how do you see this European movement from here, and why is not yet super developed over here?
Yeah, so great question, and thanks for the compliments, by the way. I think we have to take one step back very quickly to understand what America is or what Silicon Valley is. The biggest mistake you do as a European when you come here the first time, or when you think about it, is that you think, oh, Silicon Valley, you know, the source of all the wisdom, the source of all the innovation in tech, they surely should be advanced and innovative, and it should have the coolest things in the world. Then you move here. I moved here in 2012, coming from Singapore, which is instead a pretty advanced state and government and set of services for, you know, people that live there. I came here and in short order, I opened a bank account, I got a pre-approved mortgage, then bought a house a few months later, I mean, an apartment. I'm not that rich. So San Francisco, if you own a house, you're already in the 0.01% of the richest in the world. And I did a bunch of other things. So I had to deal with my ordinary life as a resident in the US. And you quickly realize that most things in the US, including especially things that deal with money and financial things, are not as advanced as you would expect. The amount of paperwork, bureaucracy, red tape, or just old processes and old approaches to things is very surprising. So with this background in mind, back to your question, Matteo. The US is indeed a big market, yes, but it's also very regulated and has probably the highest level of legacy in any, at least in any developed world's markets. And this is an opportunity for European companies, in particular for startups, in my view. And the reasons are two. Reason number one is I would challenge you to find a place in Europe where regulation and legacy are bigger than the US in fintech. Name me a country, except Vatican City maybe, and convince me that those two factors are bigger in that country compared to US. I'll pay you a beer or a dinner in San Francisco. So that's nothing like that. Which means if you have an idea, if you are executing on some type of innovation in fintech, you have to leverage the fact that there might be an angle where any American-based competitor will not be able to compete with you as effectively because of that regulation, of that bureaucracy, of that red tape, of that legacy. That's number one. Number two, a market is a generic term. When you say, what's the market for fintech services in the US in 2020? And you throw out a number based on, you know, how you look at it. But that's still a very generic, large, let's say high-level figure. The reality is that when you have a company, and especially when you have a startup, your currently addressable market is usually a tiny fraction of the total addressable market. And that means that sometimes there are great opportunities in Europe that you wouldn't have in the US. Let me make an example with Africa, not with Europe. Imagine you want to build a neobank in Africa. This is something that Matteo and I were just chatting about the other day, just for fun. What I love about Africa is that if you find a place that is not too corrupted and where the legislation, the law structure is not too convoluted, you can probably reach saturation in a market in a matter of a few years, because you go mobile, the, you know, regulation is usually very light, and again, assuming not too much corruption, not too much complexity on that front, you can actually get things done relatively quickly in terms of how you can develop that particular idea in that market. So Europe is something in between America and Africa in that regard. And to make sure I'm not mistaken, I'm not saying that doing business in Africa is super easy. But that example was for you to get an idea that America on certain things, the US, when we say America here, we intend the US, even if it's incorrect. The United States is a big market, but there is a lot of frictions in this market for fintech. And as a European company, I will try to look at places where that particular friction in the US is not present in Europe, in the equivalent counterpart in Europe. And an example is actually neobanks, as a good example in my view, because the traction and the growth of neobanks in Europe is in proportion faster than the traction that similar things have had in the US, in my view. And this is my, you know, personal view, of course, but this probably means that there was a huge desire for several European markets and customers to have a better service there, but also it was somewhat easier for the right type of entrepreneurial groups to be able to quickly try to conquer a market, maybe in a specific nation, before going elsewhere. Try to think of that as maybe what's the type of service, what's the feature, what's the functionality. And I would say anything related to debt is particularly interesting for me. Anything that allows you to democratize, to speed up, to simplify, to liquefy debt, to me would be incredibly interesting.
Simone, let's do as a last question. You were an evangelist for Amazon for a few years, so you know a thing or two about scaling, right? And you mentioned the neobanks in Europe. We just saw that Revolut has been evaluated at $5.5 billion with the last $500 million new money, fresh money. And we were talking about this not later than this morning. At the moment, there is this rush to acquiring customer, but will these neobanks scale effectively business-wise? You know, when what they do today is just a rush to customer acquisition and not, you know, not maybe yet figuring out what their business is going to be. What's your view on this?
So the answer could be complicated. Let's try to simplify. There are two things. One, sometimes it happens that companies pursue growth at all costs, and that might cost you greatly down the road if you're not careful. Look at WeWork or many other examples. And this might happen in Europe too, might happen anywhere in the world. And I think there is an importance for sound business metrics. But at the same time, it is also true that on the financial side of things, we're only scratching the surface of what's possible to do and to deliver in terms of value for these customers. I was mentioning debt just a minute or two ago. Think of how debt in your daily life could be improved by the right combination of technology and service. Imagine that you need to borrow money today. In an ideal world, you would say, I need 37,000 euros. And an algorithm will tell you immediately, yes or no, I can lend you that amount. Or maybe no, I can only lend you 22,000 euros. And two, I can do that at this particular interest rate, which somehow represents your risk profile and everything else. In an ideal world, you should be able to just say this to your Alexa in your home, and then you would have that money deposited into your bank account tomorrow morning. This is, of course, far from what happens today. The ability to have debt or credit, and therefore the two aspects of pretty much the most important financial instruments that an individual has, are still almost untapped, I think, in the everyday experience of a person living in the first world. And in that regard, we're not too far away from the opportunity that we have even elsewhere, like Africa or Asia, etc. So I think that for these companies, your question was, can they grow? Is it a sustainable growth, etc.? I think the challenge is to be able to grow not just in terms of absolute numbers, but also in terms of how deep and how profound the value that you provide to your customers is going to affect their lives. And as a consequence of that, your ability to extract money from these customers in a good way, in a meaningful way, I think will just derive from your ability to innovate. So ask yourself, yes, how can I grow fast? But also ask yourself, what can I do to untap certain type of things that these customers are unable to do today?
Simo, thank you so much for your insights. And you know what? And I'm saying it live to our auditors. I think that it would be amazing if from time to time you could just bring to the show one or two European entrepreneurs of the Valley. And actually, this could become a sort of a regular appointment for our European auditors. So they will see how is it for an European with a European mentality, knowing well the European ecosystem, develop its business or her business outside and particularly in Silicon Valley. Simone, are you up for the challenge?
Yes, of course. And thank you for having me here.
Thank you, Simo. Guys, that's a wrap. Thank you.
Do you want to be part of Breaking Banks Europe? Reach out and learn more about the opportunity to be featured in one of our shows. With over 1.6 million listeners and counting, Breaking Banks Europe is bound to become the place to advance critical dialogue in Europe and the UK fintech scene. Reach out on Instagram or Twitter at Breaking Banks EU or go to www.provoke.fm.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Breaking Banks show. And we're here after our conversation with Simone Brunozzi, based out in San Francisco. We are here with our friend Anna Herrera, connecting from New York. Hey Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Megan Johnson joined me as a co-host. Hi Megan, welcome as well.
Hello everyone.
So just as a reminder, this is basically how professionals like fintech executives and experts that worked for a long time in Europe and moved somewhere else, how they can see and explain their experience in Europe with the eyes of a fintech expert. Okay, so that's why this show is called Zooming In. And Anna is clearly one of the pioneers. I'll let her introduce herself in a little while, but I always like Anna and I, back in the time of the mythical fintech 40s, the only influencers list that ever mattered, not because I was in there, but because it was actually a very well thought through one. But Anna, tell us a little bit your story and also tell us how you and your family are, because the news coming from New York right now are not excellent.
So yeah, so we're well. Obviously, we're hunkered down at home. I guess it makes it extra difficult because we're in New York. I have a 8-month-year-old baby, and my family is all in Italy. So it's a bit hard because we're kind of in two not great places at the moment.
Yeah.
So you're here, but you would kind of rather be there, and you're isolated from everyone here. And New York is a wonderful city, but when you're locked at home and everything is shut down, you could be anywhere else. And many of us live in tiny apartments. And so it just makes it doubly hard. And obviously I'm one of the lucky ones because we're healthy and I have a job. And so, I really can't really complain. So I'm grateful that we're fine. So in terms of myself, so I started covering fintech around 2013 in London. I used to work for a Dow Jones publication called Financial News, which published the list you mentioned. I think we were probably one of the first people I talked to about fintech, or definitely early days. And when I started writing about it, it was still like people weren't sure what it was. They didn't know. It was still kind of like a niche thing. So because it was niche, no one, and I was a junior reporter, no one of the like more experienced reporters wanted to cover it. So they left it to me. I was really persistent. Then we started publishing this list of influential people in fintech in Europe. Then we started doing a quarterly publication. And then by the end of my time there, like fintech had exploded and some of the bigger outlets were hiring just fintech reporters. I'd worked at Reuters after going to journalism school. And so there was a job there just to be a fintech reporter in New York. So I applied, they hired me, and that's kind of how I moved here. I'd lived in New York before, and I wasn't too excited to like move continents again, but the job was really great. And, you know, it seemed like it was kind of made for me, you know, just being a fintech reporter after having covered it for a long time. And it was a great decision in the end because I came here and, you know, Reuters has a much bigger outreach, you know, more resources, and I was able to do really cool things from here.
Cool. That sounds really exciting, Anna. So I guess, you know, what's kind of the day-to-day life of a fintech journalist?
So right now I wake up, I go to the room next to my bedroom and I sit at my computer, but unhappier days. You know, like, I wish I could say there's more like reporting in person and we're out all day, but obviously there's a lot of just phone interviews. So, you know, you go in the office, we say you read in like any other journalist. So you read what the news are, and then, you know, you're either working on longer term projects, and so you go back to that project, or you're like covering news of the day, spot news. But there's a lot of like speaking with people on the phone, messaging people, especially when you're trying to break a story or you have a scoop, you're annoying a lot of people via text or calling them. But it's a really fun job. Sometimes I can't believe that I get paid just to be on the phone with people or go to events. It's great.
Yeah. And I mean, how, like, from your experience, would you say that kind of the US fintech scene looks to Europe for inspiration?
I think in some instances, yes. So what happens, I think, is because the US is such a massive market in itself. If you're a fintech here and that's the only market you're looking to go after at the start, you probably don't really look at Europe or know that the Europe fintech scene is so exciting. And then maybe what happens is once you start expanding abroad, you go to London and you're like, wow, there's such a big scene and everybody knows each other and they're so then you really start like appreciating the Europe scene. But if you have a sort of very like domestic business, you know, it's such a big market that you don't really need to look at Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, I guess, you know, if I guess the logical kind of comparison would be London and New York, but I think, you know, the US is quite interesting because, you know, there's quite a few different hubs, you know, Atlanta, obviously San Fran. What is New York like as a fintech hub? And, you know, would you say it's comparable to London? And if not, which other European city?
I think it's very different just because, as you said, there's another giant hub, which is the Valley. And so you do have many big fintech companies in New York, but then you have these like giant companies on the West Coast, right? Which are like by scale much bigger than the European ones, you know, if you think of Square. So New York, I think, is different because it is also like the main difference is that it's a giant banking hub and the scale of the banks here is massive. So are the banks, obviously, and London is a financial center. But, you know, when you think of the big American banks, they might have a presence in Europe, but all of their tech decisions are made out of the US. So their CTOs are all here. So, you know, I guess it feels less of a hub in the sense that there are fewer meetups and fewer events. Like, I think it's less of a big deal here, fintech in itself as a community, but there's a lot of money in it and a lot of decisions are made here. So, you know, it is a giant hub by nature, just because, you know, if you want to have Goldman Sachs buy your tech, the decision is probably made here. If JP Morgan, Chase, they're quite innovative for a bank in terms of the retail banking, probably their decisions are made here. So, you know, it is kind of a center.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you kind of mentioned those two banks, because it almost seems like, you know, the US incumbent banks are making a play for the European market, but what we're seeing is some of the, you know, European challenger banks such as N26, Monzo, Revolut, looking to enter the US market. Could you talk a bit more about, you know, how you perceive that?
So obviously it's not my job to make a judgment, but based on, you know, reporting and speaking to people here, it's still quite hard to see what their value add in the US market is. They say that, for example, you know, a lot of them talk about their great user experience. But again, like if you are a customer of one of the big banks here, the customer experience and user experience is not that awful. Like the apps are quite up to date and you get to have most of the things you need in the app and they're not terrible, right? So it's hard to see exactly what their advantage will be here. Especially because regulation is so complicated here and many of them don't have licenses, or actually none of them have licenses here yet. And so there's that extra challenge of, you know, will they get along with their banking partner? How much will they be able to innovate if they don't have that license? And so the risk of innovating actually falls on the banking partner. And also, like in the US, there's like thousands of banks, which you don't have in Europe. And so they are just adding on top of all the banks you already have.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's really interesting about the States is the presence of, you know, credit unions, and some credit unions are very niche in kind of the customers that they're going after. I mean, in terms of customers, do you get the sense that they're perceiving like an N26 and Monzo as a European bank or just, you know, a new bank?
I don't know how much recognition in general they have, right? Because I'm in a weird situation because obviously I'm aware of everything because it's my job to be, and the people around me probably are slightly more aware of everything. But I think in general, if you were on the street and you said, "Hey, have you heard of number 26 or Monzo?" they probably have no idea like what you're talking about in general, just generally, because they're so new. So it's not even a question of knowing if they're European or not. It's just a question of knowing what they are. The competition here from the big banks is like really not something you can underestimate. And I guess people were saying the same of the big banks in Europe, but it's still super early days here. And I think speaking to people who've made the switch before, I did a story recently, I guess not that recently, but in January, I think it was, about making the transition. And I was speaking to TransferWise and Klarna, who'd come here earlier, and it took them a long time to get into the American system and get brand recognition. And what they were telling me, or especially TransferWise, was, you know, you think you come here and you think that your brand just transfers over and that, you know, you've already done some of the work because, yeah, you transfer, right? But then you come here, no one really knows you. So you have to start all over again. So I wonder now, I mean, with the economic effects of the pandemic, I wonder, like, you know, people are saying that there'll be more need for digital banks, but
yeah,
I don't know if there'll be as much of a need for there'll definitely still be a need for banking, but people will have less money. So I don't know if that will translate in these banks having fewer revenues. And given the fact that they're all venture backed and many of them aren't profitable, I wonder if that's going to make them grow slower or not. It's like an added level of complication.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when you look to like a TransferWise, when they launched, like they solved a serious pain point in sending money abroad. But, you know, fast forward 7 or 8 years, that's kind of, you know, customers have plenty of choices in terms of sending money cheaply abroad. So, you know, I think about TransferWise's N26 and Monzo's and Revolut's, and, you know, what can they add that will really solve a pain point that's specific to the US consumer?
I mean, with TransferWise, what they say is there is the difference is that there is a big population of people here that are from other countries that are sending money abroad. If you think like one of the biggest remittances markets, and they're not directly after remittances, but still, it is an international transfer. It's from Mexico to the U.S. Or from the U.S. to Mexico. So, you know, there is the need for that. And they are doing well now here, I think, based on what they say. So it's slightly different. But in terms of just an online, pure online bank that just offers a checking account with, in some cases, with no extra interest, and especially now that, you know, this economic situation has changed, I wonder, like, what will set them apart from, say, Square offering Square Cash, right, which is essentially like a checking account, basically, or Robinhood doing cash management, or Wealthfront doing cash management. Like, there's so many extra options here from fintech brands that have worked for the past 10 years to get recognition. So, you know, obviously you never know, but it just seems like a super hard thing to do, break into this market as a challenger bank.
Anna, I wonder, what was your, like, the biggest thing that comes to your eyes today when you look at Europe from an US perspective? Because, and I don't want to be like too like harsh or too pragmatic, but it looks like US is more a matter of scale and less about like creativity, innovation. I mean, typically, the US banks, when it comes to fintech, I mean, I see them from here at least moving like rather slowly. And in Europe, it's of course, you know, way more, I don't want to say creative, but certainly different, right? Way more capillar, you know, different ecosystems and stuff like that. Whilst in the US, there might be less innovation, but the opportunity for scale, of course, are much bigger. Would that be a good analysis? Mm-hmm. Is that the same that you see?
I don't know. I actually think that a lot of they do have a lot of the innovation here. I mean, peer-to-peer lending, I think it kind of started here, right? Robo-advice. I think some of the models did come out from here. I think it's just like I wonder if in Europe we just talk about it more, and maybe I really don't know what the main difference here between here and Europe is in terms of, I don't know if I could say who's more innovative than the other, but for sure here, I think that overall the system is quite backwards in terms of like many areas like payments. And so I think that some of the solutions that they have here would make no sense in Europe because they're starting from a worse point, right? For example, here, banks offer you the opportunity to take pictures of your checks with your phone, right? And some of them say that was like a great innovation that happened a few years back. But to a European, that sounds insane because who writes checks? No one, right? I had to start writing checks when I moved here. I didn't even know how to fill one in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think overall, like the innovations may be equally innovative here or there, but because the whole system here is so behind, it seems like less innovative. Like even think of Venmo, right? There's no equivalent to Venmo in Europe because you can really just send money from a bank to another bank quite quickly and without like crazy fees, right? Whereas in the US, like sending money was insane. And so Venmo made sense, and then the banks launched Zelle, but they only launched Zelle because I guess they saw the competition from Venmo. But Venmo, if you look at it, isn't like a crazy innovation. It's just a great innovation for here because everything was still backwards.
Yeah. I mean, I remember kind of, you know, when Venmo was first gaining traction, quite a few banks in the UK, they were, you know, so intrigued and, oh, how do we do something like Venmo? And it's like, the UK doesn't need a Venmo, you know, there's faster payments. That's a super interesting one from the US. So do you think there's any kind of area in the US fintech scene that, you know, is lacking in Europe? Or?
I think you have sort of everything here that you would have there. But, you know, here there's more money, right? To throw it, like as Matteo was saying, scale is like a big deal. You know, here, like if a $50 million round here in the Europe is a big deal, here it's like not really. Like they have so much money to throw at companies. So I think probably that's one of the big differentiators. I don't see like anything missing here that Europe has. Aside from though, like the major thing that I was forgetting, obviously, is dysregulation and how in Europe, like especially in the UK, regulators have been very welcoming of fintech, and that has really made a difference. But just to begin with, the regulatory construct is way less complex in Europe, right? In the US, you have federal regulators for financial companies, you have state regulators, and you have several federal regulators, and then obviously, depending on where you're operating, you have several state regulators. So that's like adds another layer of complexity, which you don't have in Europe. And of course, also the fact that in Europe, they've been quite open to giving bank licenses to increase competition, whereas here they have so many banks. And so they've been very slow to give bank licenses. I mean, one of the signals of this is the fact that Lending Club decided to buy a bank, because buying a bank was going to be quicker than applying for a license. So, you know, that's a major thing that would probably help here. It's more regulatory, like the more of a streamlined regulatory process.
And I wanted to pick up, you know, when you mentioned about the, you know, the different in scale of the rounds there, right? So of course, yeah. You know, when you see a 50 million round in Europe is a big deal, and over there is more like a BAU, fine. But what about, you know, and I know that you as a reporter, you're always like looking for, you know, what is the next like a multi-$100 million deals, right? But if we talk about like the ecosystem, I don't want to say the bottom of the pyramid, but all these like Series A's and pre-Series A startup, you know very well that the ecosystem in Europe basically, you know, goes through all this plethora of, you know, incubators and accelerators and, you know, startup contests everywhere, stuff like that. Is like the same in the US, or because the scale is so different, you know, there is a lot of, hey, I know this like a multiple exit entrepreneur, and he is or she is going to be my seed or post seed. I mean, are there similarities in both the bottom of the pyramid ecosystems?
So there are accelerators here too. I'm not sure if there are as many like fintech focused these days, but they do have like obviously the really successful like 500 startups, like Combinators, those guys in San Francisco. So, you know, that's definitely something that happens. But it's also true, as there's a lot of people that have had multiple exits who then become angel investors, as well as just like a lot of rich financiers or people that have a lot of family offices, a lot of people that can invest in the early stages. So, and also the US being like, I guess, more entrepreneurial generally than Europe in some regards, or at least in the idea that you can fail and that's fine, and you can like be a and have three other companies that go bust before you get the right one, and there's no shame in that. I think they are more like pioneering, I guess. They're more like pioneers, and so they take more risks, and so there's less, there's way more capital that comes in at every level. Whereas in Europe, I remember like sometimes you speak to someone and they'll say, yeah, the problem is in Europe is we're lacking angel funding. And then you speak to someone else in another country and it's like, we do have angel funding in this country, but we lack the bigger round. So there's always a stage of the rounds that's missing for the companies to actually make a breakthrough. Although there have been like in the past few years, great companies making like having big success stories. Like if you think of Adyen, you know, it's happened. It's just way harder, I guess, because there's more challenges on every step of the way, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And I guess I think kind of, you know, my last few questions would be, what do you think the US can learn from Europe, and what do you think Europe can learn from the US?
The main thing like the US might learn from Europe is just the regulatory structures there, whereas in the US, in Europe, I guess it would be good to learn the fact that you have to be quick, and you can be a bit more risk friendly. But again, like I struggle to say what one can learn from the other, because there are big structural reasons that have been there for a century as to why one region is different from the other. So, you know, there's a reason why people take more risks here and can move fast. It's because, you know, you can hire someone in a day and you can hire someone and then fire them in 30 seconds. Whereas if you're like in Southern Europe, you know, you can't hire slowly and fire fast. That's just not the way it works, because there are laws. And, you know, even the regulations here, like it's nice to say there should be more of a, you know, Congress system, but, you know, there's reasons why the federal government can't overstep its bounds. Like the states would go insane if the federal government said from now on, we're the sole regulators of fintech companies, you have no say. Like, you know, it's just so complicated and so beyond only fintech that it would be hard. But, you know, maybe I'm overthinking it.
Anna, as part of the Italian diaspora, you know, outside of our home country, you know, can I ask you the $1 million question? If, you know, one day you would see yourself like back in Europe or maybe even in Italy, like quick.
So quick in one. Europe, it might happen sooner than you think, hopefully. So that's definitely in Italy, probably not. And it has to do both, I think, with fintech there, but also like the state of my profession, not to mention what's going on now, which is very sadly very bleak and hard to see how the country might recover economically from what's happening. So I really don't see how I could go back and like have the same level of success that I would have in another country. I think my generation is kind of a bit of a lost one, unfortunately, there. Most of my friends are everywhere. So sadly, I can't imagine myself being back there now. Who knows? But Europe, definitely. Yeah.
Great. And I feel you, my friend, when we talk about our home country. So Anna, Megan, thank you so much for being with me in this Breaking Banks Europe Outside In show. I call it Zoom In earlier, but my bad. That's another format that we have. This is called Outside In. Anna, thank you so much for being with us.
Grazie, thank you.
Good luck with your work. And Megan, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Matteo.
Thanks.
And guys, stay tuned. It's a wrap.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.